You're listening to a CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. For more continuing education activities, please visit us online at www.thebodypro.com/CME.
Hi, this is Dr. David Hardy. I'm the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and also Associate Professor of Medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine, both in Los Angeles, California. I'm going to be discussing the new class of medications called CCR5 antagonist or co-receptor antagonist. But before I actually go into the details of those clinical trials, I first of all wanted to just give some background about how chemokine co-receptors are involved in HIV entry, how they evolve over the course of HIV infection, and also how they set up a new target for the treatment of HIV infection. As you all well know, our targets for treatment of HIV infection have relied primarily upon viral targets, enzymes that are useful in reproducing the virus once it has entered into a CD4 positive T cell. We currently have one licensed medication that's also considered to be an entry inhibitor called enfuvirtide, which blocks viral fusion after the virus has sufficiently attached to the outside of a CD4 positive T cell and is now pushing its way inside that cell. As you can see from this slide, the retroviral life cycle has really provided us a multitude of many targets for which we have exploited several of them in terms of reverse transcriptase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, fusion inhibitors, and also now a new class of medications called co-receptor inhibitors as well. Another new class of medications recently brought to market in the United States and many countries around the world are the integrase inhibitors, blocking the viral integration into the host cell genome. Finally, an experimental class of medication still in development called maturation inhibitors, which are in phase 2, phase 3 studies currently. What we're going to focus on today is going to be co-receptor biology of HIV and also how this target can be therapeutically useful to us in terms of blocking the earliest steps of viral entry outside a human T cell. HIV entry is composed of probably at least three steps. These steps, as we're going to look at them today, are sequential steps, but they may actually kind of overlap and have different sorts of activity over time. As we can see here, the first step in HIV entry is the CD4 cell binding, in which the CD4 cell protein on the outside of a T cell, first of all, binds to a specific part of this GP120 viral protein, the outside glycoprotein. A part of the GP120 molecule that was previously unexposed becomes exposed through a conformational change that's caused by the initial CD4 cell binding, which makes the V3 loop available for binding to the second particle on the outside of a human T cell called the chemokine receptor. We'll talk more about chemokine receptors in a few minutes. After the virus is then firmly attached to the cell by both CD4 and chemokine receptor binding, the virus then basically harpoons the cell with its GP41 protein, shown in red in the slide. And then after this, the GP41 basically folds over on itself, allowing for close contact between the viral envelope and the plasma cell membrane, so that these membranes then basically fuse and allow for the genetic material and enzymes of HIV to be pushed inside the human cell, and thus infection has occurred. There are many molecules that have been developed to block CD4 cell binding, as well as co-receptor binding, and also as well as fusion. Enfuvirtide is our licensed medication for blocking the fusion step. We now have one licensed medication called Maraviroc, as I approved CCR5 antagonist, a second in development called Vicrovirok, and then several molecules, as we see now here on this slide, that are still in either preclinical or clinical testing. Let's break this down a little bit more to kind of get a better feeling for really what the biology of the interaction between a human T cell and HIV are all about. This slide shows the surface of a CD4 positive T cell and basically shows the triad of how the CD4 molecules shown here in pink and the chemokine receptors, either CCR5 shown in orange or CXCR4 here shown in green, are configured on the outside of a human T cell. As you can see, these molecules are all put in a grouping of three or a triad, so that it really takes triple binding each time for this interaction between virus and human T cell to occur. Next slide shows basically how the viral particle is now descending upon a human T cell, and we can see the outermost part of the particle called the glycoprotein 120, GP120 on the outside of the virus, getting closer and closer to the CD4 molecule. When these two molecules become very close, you can see that there is a specific binding between GP120 and the three CD4 cell molecules. This creates a conformational change, which basically flips open the part of the GP120 molecule previously hiding the V3 loop. The V3 loop is now exposed, and with this exposure comes a second binding of the GP120 molecule and the chemokine receptor, in this case, a CCR5 molecule. This is actually done in triplicate, as one can see, to really firmly bind the viral particle to the human T cell. Once firmly bound, one can see that there's a quick and efficient harpooning of the human T cell by GP41. And with that, the folding over of the GP41 molecule, pulling the envelope of the virus close to the plasma membrane of the cell, fusion occurs between these two surfaces, and with this, a pore is created, allowing for the entrance of the HIV RNA and other associated enzymes into the human T cell, and thus infection has occurred. Let's move on now to an actual history about tropism. This is a fairly new science. It was first discovered about 10 to 12 years ago and has offered us a huge new understanding of how HIV interacts with our human T cells. CCR5 and CXCR4 are chemokine receptors. Chemokine receptors are expressed on the outside of immune cells and other antigen-presenting cells. They allow these cells to be able to interact with each other through chemoattractive cytokines. Cytokines such as MIP-1-alpha, MIP-1-beta, and RANTES are all some of the molecules that are the natural ligands or binders of these chemokine receptors. HIV has been able to evolve to where it can also utilize these chemokine receptors, not as immune correspondents, but actually as a way to bind and get inside the cell, as we saw before. We know that the normal function of chemokine receptors is to allow for T-cell migration to different inflammatory areas, as well as immune response to the various antigens. This next slide shows basically how CCR5 and CXCR4, the two most commonly used chemokine receptors for HIV infection, are actually very similar in terms of they are 7 transmembrane proteins, meaning that they traverse the human T-cell plasma membrane 7 times and have both an intracellular and extracellular regions. Those extracellular regions are important in terms of the specificity of the amino acids within them, which allow the HIV virus to recognize and attach in a very specific way. CCR5 viruses, known for short, just R5 viruses, are what we used to call M-tropic, macrophage-tropic, or NSI, non-syncytium-inducing viruses. These viruses make up for about 98 to 99% of all new infections of HIV and are prevalent early in HIV infection and disease. CXCR4 viruses, or for short, X4 viruses, are also known as T-tropic, T-cell-tropic, or SI, syncytium-inducing viruses. As we know from studies of the evolution of HIV infection, these viruses emerge late in HIV disease and have been associated with rapid CD4 cell decline. We also know that there are certain viruses called mixed or dual tropic viruses. This slide shows how X4 viruses infect primarily T cell lines by using the CXCR4 coreceptor on those cells, and also primary lymphocytes such as naive and memory CD4 cells. R5 viruses infect primarily macrophage, monocytes, and dendritic cells, which allows for some of the reason why new infections are associated with this type of virus. Primary lymphocytes can express both CXCR4 and CCR5 over different stages of their lifetime. A dual-tropic virus then would be able to infect this kind of cell because it expresses both co-receptors. We've learned over time some very interesting genetics of the CCR5 gene. As you all know, we receive an allele from each parent of CCR5, and it's been determined that about 5 to 14% of Caucasians, primarily from Northern European descent, carry a specific deletion in the CCR5 gene called Delta 32, which makes half of that person's genes unable to express the CCR5 protein. In addition, we've also learned that about 1% of persons have dual Delta 32 deleted genes from each one of their parents and are considered to be CCR5 Delta 32 homozygotes. This means that their T cells cannot express any CCR5 molecules on their surface and therefore are basically unable to be infected by CCR5 tropic virus. They can, however, become infected from an X4 virus. Interestingly, the origin of this CCR5 Delta 32 allele has been traced back to European geography, first thought to occur about 1,000 years ago, and possibly as a positive selection against a pandemic pathogen such as smallpox or perhaps the bubonic plague, something that in persons who did not have wild-type genes but rather had Delta 32 deleted genes were those who survived the bubonic plague or smallpox. As one can see from this map, areas of Europe where the Delta 32 prevalence is high are in Northern Europe. It decreases going southward through Central and Southern Europe. Seems to be also rather high in areas where migration occurred from Northern Europe in the U.S., Canada, and also Australia, and seems to be very rare in other parts of the world such as Africa, Asia, and South America. Persons who are considered to be perhaps wild-type or normal, these individuals have wild-type genes from both parents, have a normal amount of CCR5 expression on their T-cells, normal progression of HIV infection if infected, and also have normal immune function. Persons who are heterogeneous for this gene containing one wild-type and one Delta 32 allele also have CCR5 expression, but in a decreased amount, probably half of what the normal persons have. This can be associated with HIV infection, but with delayed progression and CD4 cell depletion and AIDS and death. These persons also have normal immune functions. And finally, in the situation when both alleles are Delta 32 in origin, these individuals have no CCR5 expression on their T cells, therefore cannot be infected with an R5 tropic virus, can have rare infection, however, with X4 tropic virus, but interestingly do have normal immune function. There's been some concern that in individuals who are homozygotes for Delta 32 may not have entirely normal immune function, in that a small handful of cases of individuals who developed neurologic involvement with West Nile infection in some parts of the United States. Patients who have been followed over time and who are known to be heterozygous for the CCR5 Delta 32 gene have shown that there's a slower time to progression to developing AIDS and also slower time to death, statistically different from individuals who are wild type for this gene, indicating that there's some protection that seems to occur with the decrease in the amount of available CCR5. And of course, this starts to provide some therapeutic decision making as to how this decrease in CCR5 expression could be used in a therapeutic nature. In order for us to better understand how we can characterize viruses, a new assay called the tropism assay has been developed. This assay is, I think, a further extension in better characterizing individual patients' viruses in order to be able to better understand what the progression of that patient's disease may be with HIV infection, and also to understand better what kind of therapeutic agents, in this case CCR5 antagonists, may or may not be effective in treating that patient. A tropism assay is, in fact, required before one decides to use a CCR5 antagonist. Individuals who have CCR5 tropic virus will be expected to respond well to an HIV regimen containing a CCR5 antagonist. Those who have either dual mixed or primarily X4 type virus would not be expected to respond well to a CCR5 containing regimen. Let's look at the assay that's now available in the United States and has been clinically validated in terms of being used in pretty much all of the currently completed and ongoing treatment protocols with R5 and X4 antagonists. The tropism assay is a further use of the platform developed for the phenotypic expression of resistance to reverse transcriptase inhibitors and protease inhibitors, and been available for some many years. Basically, what they do is to create a viral vector using the patient's envelope gene and cloning that into with another vector called a luciferase expression vector, which allows for light to be emitted in a infected cell. When these two vectors are transfected or forced to go inside of a virus-producing cell, particles called pseudovirions are generated, which will express what a patient's envelope glycoproteins actually will show. These viruses are then put in contact with two different kinds of cells. both of these cells express CD4 molecules on the surface, and then some express either CCR5 or CXCR4. When these pseudovirions are put into contact with these cells, either the cells can infect the CCR5 expressing cells and not the CXCR4 positive cells, and therefore this virus would be characterized as being a CCR5 or R5 COVID virus. If the virus infects only the CXCR4 expressing cells, we know that this virus is then only an X4 virus because it cannot and does not infect the CCR5 expressing cells. However, in the case in which the virus population can infect both of these cells, CCR5 and CXCR4 expressing cells, this is either a dual tropic virus or a mixed population of viruses that contain both R5 and X4 tropic viruses. Let's look at how this can actually occur in terms of what the tropism test can tell us. As this next slide shows in graphic form, an R5 virus in the orange there will infect a CCR5 expressing cell. Light generated when the viral particle infects a cell and a readout of light expression is shown to be positive. When the same virus then tries to infect an X4 expressing cell, it cannot attach to the cell and therefore no light is generated. Let's look at a dual tropic virus. This virus expresses both CCR5 and CXCR4 binding molecules on its surface and therefore can infect both an R5 virus, as shown here, as well as infect an X4 virus, shown here, with light expressed from both cell populations. Finally, we can also look at a population of viruses, as shown in this slide, in which there's viruses that are R5, some are X4, and some are dual viruses, and therefore when it comes up to the R5 virus, it can infect that and express life. And this virus population can also infect the X4 virus and express life. Just as a little quiz, what kind of population do we see here? We see primarily R5 tropic viruses, but behind there's kind of hidden behind is one X4 virus. So this population can infect both R5 expressing cells, and in smaller numbers also infect the X4 expressing cells. This really points out how important it is to be able to detect not so much the R5 population, but primarily the X4 population, especially when we're talking about whether or not we can use currently licensed class of medications called R5 inhibitors. Because what we really want to know is how much X4 virus is actually in that population that may not be affected by the R5 antagonist. This next slide shows how this tropism test has been improved since it was made available about a year ago. The old test had the sensitivity of being able to detect down to a 10% minimum of X4 expressing virus, meaning that it could detect the population if it was 10% or greater of X4, but if it was less than 10%, this assay was not able to accurately identify those low levels of X4 virus. With some specific sort of enhancements, this assay has now been improved so that it can actually now detect down to a X4 using virus population of around 0.3%, markedly increasing the sensitivity of this assay to be able to identify any X4 virus that may be in the viral population and therefore more accurately characterize what the tropism of this population will be and therefore what kind of medications would work well against it. We know that co-receptor tropism evolves over time, and let's look at some of the epidemiologic data that we have available to us in terms of seeing how this actually happens. From several cohorts of patients who were naive to therapy but about to start therapy, we know that the majority of the viruses contained in these persons is R5 virus. Somewhere between 80 to almost 90% of naive HIV-positive patients will have R5 tropic virus. Smaller proportion, somewhere between 10 to as high as 20%, will have dual mixed virus. A very small population, less than 1%, will have only X4. Over time, what we actually notice is that co-receptor usage actually evolves. And when we look at populations of patients who are considered to be treatment experienced, some of them very highly treatment experienced, as shown in this slide from the Toro population and also the Motivate 1 and 2 studies, we see that in these highly treatment experienced patients, the usage of R5 viruses actually decreases from 80 to 90% down to around 40 to 50%. The proportion of patients' viruses that use R5 and X4 actually increases to around 40 to 50%. And X4 only using viruses increases a bit to somewhere between 2 to 4%. This evolution of tropism usage occurs over the course of HIV treatment history, and whether or not it's caused by that is really not clearly understood. What we do know about tropism usage by HIV from this study by Broom and others is that as the CD4 cell count decreased, the use of X4 increased. The mean CD4 cell count in patients who had X4 virus was 110 versus a median CD4 cell count of 290 in those who had R5 using viruses. Viral load is also a bit higher, 175,000 copies versus 120,000 copies in X4 versus R5 virus, respectively. Whether or not the use of X4 is caused by the drop in CD4 cell count is still not clearly understood. All we know for sure right now is that these two things are in fact associated. What happens in terms of patients who are determined to be R5 or X4 over time? What happens when they get treated in terms of response to heart regimens? A cohort of patients in London in which individuals naive to therapy and followed over time for the progression of HIV infection had their viruses tested for tropism. 402 naive patients, 326 were found to be R5, 73 were found to have dual mixed virus, and 3 patients were found to have X4. By August of 2006, 340 of these 402 patients had started on heart therapy. 229 of the R5 virus patients, 60 of the dual mixed patients, and 51 had been excluded from analysis for various reasons. Let's look at the 2-year follow-through of these patients who were determined to have R5 or X4 virus. Looking at their CD4 cell count progression over time, a statistically greater fall in CD4 cell count occurred in those patients who were found to have some X4 virus in their viral population over 2 years of no treatment follow-up. However, when treatment was in fact initiated in these patients, the proportion of patients achieving a viral load less than 50 copies of becoming undetectable was in fact no different in these patients whether they had R5 or a dual mixed X4 containing viral population, showing that there does seem to be some natural history difference between these two viral populations, but no real difference in terms of treatment. A similar sort of study was actually done in those patients in the Toro study who were R5 only or X4 containing viral populations. In terms of response to therapy, there was in fact no difference in terms of X4 or R5 tropic viruses. As this slide shows, in terms of response rates to heart, and those patients who are R5 tropic or had some X4 tropic virus, the CD4 cell rise at 12 and 24 months was really no different. In terms of proportion of patients who had undetectable virus at 12 or 24 months was really no different as well. So both by immunologic as well as virologic criteria, really no difference in terms of treatment response, whether it's R5 or X4 virus. Now let's move on to some of the clinical trials with CCR5 antagonists. There is one agent that has been approved by the FDA called Maraviroc, specifically for patients who are highly treatment experienced. The Motivate 1 and 2 studies is responsible for licensure of this medication in the U.S. and in several countries throughout the world. Motivate 1 and 2 are international ongoing trials that enrolled a little over 1,000 patients worldwide. These patients had to have triple-class experience or proven triple-class resistance to nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors. All these patients were, at screening, determined to have R5 tropic viruses to be entered into this trial with this R5 antagonist. All patients were given an optimized background therapeutic regimen based upon a baseline genotype, phenotype, and T20 sensitivity assays. Added to that optimized background regimen was placebo, Maraviroc given once a day, or Maraviroc given twice a day. This next slide shows some of the baseline characteristics of the patients enrolled in the study. Now, these individuals were in their mid to late 40s. Around 10 to 12% were female. The majority, around 80-85%, were Caucasian. CD4 cell counts in these three arms of the study were all less than 200. The viral loads were somewhere around 70,000 to 80,000, and the majority of patients, two-thirds of the patients, had less than 2 active drugs in their background optimized regimen. Around 40 to 45% of patients received T20 as part of their regimens, and a very small number of patients, around 12 to 15%, received tipranovir. Of note, darunavir, our newest protease inhibitor, was not allowed to be used in the study because of lack of knowledge of the drug-to-drug interaction between Maraviroc and darunavir. The bottom line is that the difference in the primary endpoint of suppression of viral load from baseline to week 48 showed a statistically and clinically significant greater viral load suppression with both doses of Maraviroc, either given once a day or twice a day, compared to placebo. The difference was almost one log between placebo and both arms of the Maraviroc-treated patients. Here's the secondary endpoints, a proportion of patients who had less than 400 copies or less than 50 copies of virus at week 48, averaging around 43% to 45% in the Maraviroc arms compared to just under 17% in the patients receiving placebo. There was almost a tripling in terms of better suppression with Maraviroc-containing regimens. The CD4 cell count increase in this patient was also of note at 48 weeks. The Maraviroc arms both had well over 100 new CD4 cells increased compared to baseline, 124 for the Maraviroc twice-a-day arm, 116 average increase in CD4 cell count for the once-a-day Maraviroc arm compared to 61 cells for the placebo arm. As we can also see here, there was a difference in terms of where the patient's baseline viral load was as they started. However, there was significant increases in terms of better viral load suppression with Maraviroc compared to placebo, whether the patient's viral load was above or below 100,000. Similar sort of results are seen based upon baseline CD4 cell count. There was better suppression of HIV based upon the number of CD4 cells at baseline with both Maraviroc arms compared to placebo. However, this did vary as the CD4 cell count increased, becoming increasingly better with more CD4 cells, as one might expect. This trend is something that has been seen in pretty much all of our treatment-experienced protocols. One of the most interesting things I think about this medication is that its adverse event profile seems to be very good. Although the total exposure time to the Maraviroc versus placebo was in fact different, almost three times longer in the Maraviroc-treated patients, the proportion of patients having any kind of treatment-emergent adverse events leading to discontinuation of therapy, serious adverse events, Category C, new AIDS events, or malignancies, there was really no difference between the Maraviroc-treated patients and those receiving placebo. One concern, of course, about this class of agents has been what effect it may have on the liver. As one can see here, the proportion of patients in the Maraviroc arms compared to the placebo arms was really no different for both grade 3, grade 4 increases in AST, ALT, or total bilirubin, indicating really no significant signal of any kind of hepatic toxicity with this agent. In terms of patient-reported adverse events, what we can see here is that the most common events that usually occur in clinical trials with antiretroviral agents, such as diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, headache, were really no different between those patients receiving Maraviroc or those receiving placebo. The things that did stand out that were more commonly associated with Maraviroc treatment were, in fact, upper respiratory tract infection, cough, and nasopharyngitis. One of the hypotheses of this, why this occurred this way, was simply that Maraviroc patients were on treatment longer, that the opportunity for them to develop a seasonal URI was greater than those patients who were in the placebo arm who stopped medication more quickly. In summary, the MOTIVATE 1 and 2 studies showed us that Maraviroc was an effective agent when added to an optimized background regimen compared to placebo in suppressing viral load by almost an additional log, almost doubling CD4 cell count increases, and being associated with few, if any, significant adverse events, either patient-reported or laboratory events, and has a very good tolerance and toxicity profile. A second CCR5 antagonist is also in clinical development, a medication called Vicroviroc, being developed in also treatment-experienced patients, has been shown in a phase 2B clinical trial to have significant antiviral activity. Patients who were triple class experienced with nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors, and also determined to be CCR5 tropic in terms of viral tropism, were randomized to optimized background regimen along with Vicroviroc dosed at 20 milligrams once a day, 30 milligrams once a day, or a placebo. Of note, all patients' optimized background regimen did have to contain a ritonavir boost PI because of the boosting effect that ritonavir has on Vicroviroc that allows for lower doses to be used on a once-a-day basis. At 48 weeks of follow-up, we see a significant decrease in viral load in the two Vicroviroc arms of approximately 1.75, 1.77 log compared to baseline, which is almost an additional one log increase over those patients who were receiving placebo. The proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 copies at 48 weeks was 56% in the 30 milligram arm, 53% in the 20 milligram arm, compared to only 14% in those patients that received placebo, showing a more than tripling effect in terms of the addition of Vicrovirox to an optimized background medication. There's really no significant clinical differences in adverse events seen between Vicrovirox and placebo, and really no difference in terms of laboratory abnormalities as well. This study was a small study containing about 60 patients per arm, and therefore the phase 3 trial of this medication is to be done and will be done in comparison to the only agent also in this class that has been approved called Maraviroc, as we saw before. As one might expect, perhaps one of the best places to use CCR5 antagonists is where that type of virus, an R5 type of virus, is most common, and that is in patients who are naive to therapy. The MERIT study is a trial that is still ongoing, but actually looked at the comparison of Maraviroc plus zidovudine plus 3TC versus efavirenz plus zidovudine and 3TC in treatment-naive patients. All these patients were determined to have R5 tropic virus at screening into the trial and were followed in a very stringent non-inferiority-based study to see whether or not the Maraviroc arm was, in fact, non-inferior to the efavirenz-containing arm. This study was stratified not only by whether or not the baseline RNA was above or below 100,000 copies, but also by where the patient was treated in the northern or southern hemisphere, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. In terms of the primary endpoint in the study, looking at proportion of patients that had viral loads less than 400 copies at 48 weeks, really no significant difference. In fact, the two drugs were considered to be non-inferior, with 73% of patients in the efavirenz arm versus 71% in the Maraviroc arm having well-suppressed virus at 48 weeks. However, when one looked at the proportion of patients who had less than 50 copies of virus at 48 weeks, this turned out to be 69% with efavirenz and 65% with Maraviroc. This comparison did not reach non-inferiority, and in fact, it missed it by approximately 0.9 percentage points difference. Therefore, this trial did not prove that Maraviroc was non-inferior to efavirenz at its primary endpoint of less than 50 copies at this one-year follow-up. In this study, it was more likely that patients in the efavirenz arm would discontinue therapy due to an adverse event, 13%, versus a lack of efficacy, only 4.2%. However, the opposite was seen with Maraviroc. The patients were more likely to discontinue therapy because of lack of efficacy, about 12%, versus discontinuation due to an adverse event, about 4%. What we see here is that there's a difference in efficacy, but really also a difference in terms of adverse events. The interesting thing in this study was that when one looked at the proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 at 48 weeks, if a patient's baseline viral load was less than 100,000 copies, really no difference between the efavirenz arm and the Maraviroc arm. However, there was evidence of a drop-off in response rate with Maraviroc at 48 weeks if a patient's viral load was greater than 100,000 copies, 67% versus 60%. Some of this may have been due to the fact that in addition to the viral load stratification of above and below 100,000, these patients were also stratified by whether they lived in the northern or southern hemisphere. This was done primarily because almost all patients enrolled in the study were enrolled in areas of the world such as North America, Western Europe, Australia, Argentina, where all patients did in fact have clade B virus. However, one of the largest enrolling centers in the southern hemisphere, namely South Africa, in that area, patients primarily have type C or clade C virus. The reason the stratification occurred, therefore, was because it was not known whether or not the difference in clade would be responsible for differences in response rate. And whether or not this did have an effect on this trial has yet to really be clearly understood. When looking at the adverse event analysis, in terms of the MERIT study, there was, in fact, a slightly increased amount of grade 3 and grade 4 adverse events associated with the efavirenz, as well as more significant serious adverse events, and also increased category C events, as well as malignancies. One important analysis that was, in fact, done later in the study of the MERIT population was to look at baseline tropism. It is true that while all patients coming into the study had to have R5 tropic virus at screening, approximately 3.5% of these patients did in fact not have R5 tropic virus at baseline, meaning that there was a shift in virus between the screening sample and the baseline sample. When one looks at the response rate in patients who had R5 tropic virus both at screening as well at baseline. The difference in terms of response rate was actually really no different between the efavirenz and maraviroc arms at 48 weeks. However, if one looks at those patients who switched, that 3.5% of patients who had R5 tropic virus at screening but had switched to X4 containing virus detected at baseline, that the response rate for both arms was in fact very different. Only 55% of patients responded in the efavirenz arm, but a very small number, only 7% of patients responded to less than 50 copies in the maraviroc arm, indicating that this change in tropism had a much greater deleterious effect in the maraviroc arm versus those patients who received efavirenz, again, as one might expect. It has been hypothesized that if the newer assay, the enhanced sensitivity assay, was used in the study, those patients would have been screened out, and if the results may have been very different in terms of non-inferiority. One thing we also learned from the MERIT study was to get a really good look at what kind of effect maraviroc may have on lipid levels. As one can see here in this next slide, while the increases that have been demonstrated before in other trials with efavirenz, we see similar sort of increases in total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, being higher with efavirenz compared to that with maraviroc. In fact, the differences between baseline and week 48 for lipids really showed no significant difference with total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, or triglycerides across the board with maraviroc, indicating this drug seems to have very little, if any, effect on lipid levels whatsoever. In summary then, what I can say to you about this area of new HIV therapeutics, that chemokine co-receptors do in fact play an important role in the early steps of HIV infection, and this allows for us a new and very useful target in terms of interfering with the ability of HIV to initially infect a cell. The prevalence of viral co-receptor tropism evolves over the course of HIV infection and is associated with, although perhaps maybe or may not caused by, a decrease in CD4 cell count and also treatment experience. A tropism assay, which has now been clinically validated, is available and can detect with great sensitivity a patient's viral tropism, which can then have us better choose whether we want to use a CCR5 antagonist. Maraviroc is the first approved agent in the new class of CCR5 antagonists and has demonstrated therapeutic activity and also increase in CD4 cells in treatment-experienced patients. Its use in treatment-naive patients still remains a question to be resolved with more data over time. Nicroviroc is a CCR5 antagonist currently in development, also being studied primarily in patients who are treatment-experienced and waiting for the results of a Phase 3 trial comparing it to our first licensed agent, maraviroc. Let me now take some questions that have been collected by the BodyPro website involving viral tropism and the use of CCR5 antagonists. The question is, has anyone who was being treated with a CCR5 antagonist, in this case either maraviroc or vicroviroc through a clinical trial, developed West Nile virus or severe complications associated with it? Let me just expand a little bit on my comments about the association of the patients who are known to be CCR5 homozygotes for the deleted gene, meaning they have no CCR5 molecules on the surface of their T cells or other immune cells like macrophages, and West Nile virus. What is known really in a handful of patients, and as I've looked at the literature about this, I've really found less than 5 case reports of patients who are homozygous genetically and who have developed West Nile and have developed more significant neurologic disease associated with it, which is considered to be a more serious sort of problem with West Nile virus. To my knowledge, there has been no patient in a clinical trial with either maraviroc or vicroviroc or in clinical practice with maraviroc who's developed West Nile or any serious complications from it. This is probably because of the fact that while maraviroc is somewhat like a genetically homozygous deleted patient for CCR5, it's not exactly like that. That means that these patients still probably have some expression of CCR5 on some of their immune cells. As good as maraviroc or vicroviroc could ever be, it could not, in fact, completely block all CCR5 molecules on the surface of the cell, so that there's still ability for these immune cells to use that co-receptor in a way that immune defenses could, in fact, be continued. That's my hypothesis about it anyway. Clinically, I do not know of any increase in West Nile virus with these two agents. The question is the new tropism enhanced sensitivity test sensitive enough in terms of now more accurately identifying patients who may have some X4 virus in the viral population? With a significant improvement in the ability of the assay to detect very low levels of X4 virus, meaning down to 0.3% of the entire viral population, and some of the clinical uses of this assay in terms of going back and looking at some of those trials in which the older assay was used and did in fact miss some of the patients that did have X4, but the older assay failed to identify them. And this assay has in fact been about 70% effective in being able to identify X4 virus in those patients. So the assay, I think, is going to be and is doing a much better job at finding X4 virus and letting the treating physician know about it. My concern about it is that it may actually go the other way, that it may be too sensitive, and that what we may be seeing here is that, similar to what we've seen with minority variant populations of viruses, in which very low levels of perhaps NNRTI resistance mutations have been seen, that even though those mutations are there, they do not always predict that a patient will fail an NNRTI-based regimen. Now, we don't know with 100% sensitivity that this is in fact occurring yet, as this assay has only really been out available for 3 months in the United States. It came out in June of 2008. But what we do know is that it is doing a very good job of finding very, very low levels of X4, and I think with that, we're going to be able to use agents like Maraviroc and Vicarvirac much, much more effectively. The question is a second clinical trial in treatment-naive patients going to be done with Maraviroc with the more sensitive assay? One would think, based upon that analysis, that post-hoc analysis from the MERIT study, in which it was determined that patients did, in fact, have switching between screening and baseline, that perhaps a second study would, in fact, be more effectively done with the new assay, excluding those patients that did, in fact, have some low-level X4 virus that wasn't detected in the first trial. I doubt that the companies that are making these agents will want to repeat a study as large as the MERIT trial. The expenditures to do that trial, especially on an international basis, were, I'm sure, tremendous. Probably what's going to happen is that Maraviroc will continue to be studied in naive patients in a different way, coupled with a more novel sort of regimen, perhaps with a unboosted protease inhibitor, perhaps boosted with one nucleoside analog, perhaps compared with one of our new second-generation NNRTIs like etravirine, in a way that will look at Maraviroc in treatment-naive patients, but in a different fashion than the MERIT study did, putting it together in a more updated and more current sort of regimen. Of course, the tropism enhanced sensitivity assay will, in fact, be used and will really, I think, give us a much better population, a more well-defined population of patients to study with this kind of agent. So look for that in the future. The question is, who is the best patient for the use of a CCR5 antagonist? Well, the ideal patient, I think, you know, in terms of all things considered, would be the patient that is probably as close to their infection with HIV as possible, meaning that those are the patients who have the highest likelihood of having R5 tropic virus, where this medication seems to work best. The place where the drug has been used most commonly and is actually approved for usage right now is in the highly treatment-experienced patients, where patients actually need a brand-new agent. You know, where I have been finding it's used to be the most beneficial right now is really not in the salvage-type patient, those who have very little of any kind of medication regimens available to them, as was studied in the MOTIVATE trial, because oftentimes what we're seeing there is that the chances that that patient has an R5 tropic virus is really falling down pretty low, sometimes less than 30-40%. Probably the better place to use this agent would be, say, after the second regimen fails and the probability of a patient's virus being R5 tropic is much higher than waiting for the 5th, 6th, 7th regimen to fail. At that point, that patient has already gone through basically two nucleoside backbones, usually an NNRTI and a boosted PI. You know, this may be the perfect place to use Maraviroc because of the fact that the chances of having the right kind of virus is going to be there, the toxicity profile of the drug seems to be very good, and that it can be coupled with many other agents because the drug-drug interactions have been clearly worked out, and the fact that, you know, a new agent could be used very effectively at that point. Basically, what I say is that as soon as I do the tropism assay and find the patient has R5 tropic virus, that's when I use the medication. Waiting to use the medication and hoping that that assay is going to continue to show the same result could be a big problem. This is where I'll end. I hope you were able to learn something new from this presentation and be able to use this information to treat your patients better.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. Thank you for listening to this CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. Be sure to visit us online for more continuing education activities at www.thebodypro.com/CME.